everyone, Justin Chisholm here with the fourth of our exclusive member-only episodes for March 2021 on the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. My guest this time is Australian professional yachtsman Kyle Langford, winner of the 34th America's Cup as wing trimmer with Oracle Team USA, and also winner of the first season of SailGP as the wing trimmer for Tom Slingsby's Australian SailGP team. Now based in Gothenburg, Sweden, Kyle talks me through his first experiences of sailing as a demanding four-year-old on Australia's Lake Macquarie, his early days of dinghy sailing, followed by an aborted Olympic campaign that was the trigger for him to set his sights on somehow finding a route into the America's Cup through the World Match Racing Tour. It's a long interview in which we also cover off his two America's Cup cycles with Oracle Team USA, his first ever ocean race experience on the last edition of the Ocean Race, as well as his newfound love for ice boating, which he tried his hand at earlier this year. Kyle Langford, welcome to the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. You're talking to me from Gothenburg in Sweden, which I'd forgotten was where you were based. How long have you as an Australian been based out in Gothenburg?
Well, firstly, thanks for having me. Yeah, I'm living in Sweden now, originally from Australia. I've been off and on here for maybe 10 years and really only living here full time since Corona started. So, yeah, 12 months actually. So as an Australian, as a professional sailor, you know, you kind of got to be over in Europe, and I chose this as a home base, and got a girlfriend here, and so this is my life now.
And how's the lockdown experience been for you guys over there? We've spoken to quite a few people in different places, and everybody's had similar and differing experiences. But how's it been for you in Sweden?
I think Sweden and the media has copped it. For me personally, it's actually been quite nice. It's been a pretty relaxed year, and it's really the first time in 10 years that I've actually had a serious amount of time in one place with nothing to do. So I've actually had an amazing year, you know, despite the terrible circumstances going on around the world.
And what would you do to occupy yourself? Because there's some long, cold winters in Sweden. Gothenburg is beautiful, but the winters, huh?
Yeah, it's a bit of a difference, the winter. This year I've been doing a lot of kiteboarding, foiling, wing foiling, moth sailing. And as the winters come around and everything's turned to snow and ice, I've been doing some snow kiting, and I recently went ice sailing. So plenty of activities, and I've actually just come back from a week of skiing. So plenty of activities. I think if it wasn't for, you know, if I didn't have the ability to go outside and do some fun things, then I'd probably go pretty crazy.
Sounds like a pretty active lifestyle. You must be as fit as you are when you're normally in promo, aren't you?
I wish I was. Unfortunately not. No, too many beers and too many burgers. So I've got to crack the whip and get ready for this coming sailing season and get back in shape.
That's great. Now, before we move on from Sweden, how's your Swedish?
Not good. I'm trying to learn. There's actually quite a few Australians here and Kiwis, all sailors who have managed to end up here. And we're all pretty terrible, but we've got a bet going now to see who can be the first one to learn Swedish. So there is a bit of a financial incentive to be, you know, to be good at it. So, you know, maybe this will be the year I learn.
Yeah, it doesn't seem to me to be a straightforward language to learn, but an incentive is always good.
Yeah.
So, yeah, well, we'll maybe keep a check on that one. Now, let's take you back to, I like to, with my guests, talk about how they got into sailing and how their route evolved to being professional sailors. And now Lake Macquarie is one of the names that comes up quite a lot. Chris Nicholson was on the podcast a few weeks ago, and of course that's his stomping ground, and that's where you originate from too. Were you born around that area?
Yeah, I was. I grew up in Lake Macquarie. I was born there. Both my parents are sailors, and my grandparents on both sides were sailors recreationally. And so when, you know, I'm the youngest of three, so I've got an older brother and an older sister, and we went down to the local sailing club to learn how to sail, and my brother was out there in the Learn to Sail, and he's 4 years older, and my parents said that I just wouldn't let it go. You know, as a four-year-old, I wanted to be out there with him. And when I was 4 years old, I did the Learn to Sail, which was not encouraged. I was under the minimum age. I think it was six that you had to be, but my parents said they just couldn't deal with me, not wanting to go out sailing. So they had to convince the guys to let me join the Learn to Sail, and off we went.
And your parents were active racers or sailors? How does it work in Australia? The yacht clubs are fully racing, or is there a kind of cruising element to it as well?
They were more cruisers. We had a small boat growing up, and we used to spend every single holiday out on the boat, and really only on Lake Macquarie. It's a coastal lake, but it's got over 200 kilometres of coastline. And so it's quite a big lake, and you know, on a small boat and with a young family, we're out there kind of every single holiday, spending a few weeks on the boat, cruising around, and then on the weekends we would go to the local sailing club, and we were sailing Sabos, which is like an optimist, I guess, and we'd learn to sail and learn to race, but basically our lives revolved around being on the water, and we were out there, you know, all the time. And if my parents weren't taking us out, you know, we were pushing our parents to take us out, you know, my brother and my sister and I.
Can you remember back to your very first time going sailing? Perhaps it kind of away from the family, maybe perhaps it was that Learn to Sail program. Can you remember the experience?
I can vaguely remember sailing with my brother and absolutely hating it. And it was more the sailing with him than the actual sailing itself, I think. Obviously, even as young kids, we were both competitive, and we were fighting all the time and, you know, pushing each other, and I guess as young kids do. And so I remember sailing with my brother and not really enjoying it that much. And then I remember, you know, another memory I have is just sailing a Sabo with a school friend of mine, and that's when I was like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm in charge now. This is fun, kind of thing.
Right.
That's
quite a familiar tale from the interviews that we do on the podcast. You're not the first person to tell us that once they were given control, sailing then became a much more appealing sport.
Yeah.
But were there any other sports that you were taking part in then? Because you're a pretty active guy now, but it can't have just been sailing, was it?
No, when I was younger, I played soccer. I was terrible. I was actually not that great, not great hand-eye coordination, unfortunately. But I did a lot of swimming, and I was quite a good swimmer as a kid, and trained 8 2-hour sessions a week. The morning sessions, had to leave home at 4:30 in the morning. Started training at 5 for 2 hours before school, and get the bus to school, and straight from school back to swimming practice. And so that was pretty intense. And I think that was kind of it required a lot of discipline and also a lot of help from my parents to get me to and from training as a 12, 13 year old. And then, you know, on the weekends, if I wasn't racing with swimming, I was going out sailing, you know, with my mates, and I kind of realized that, you know, with sailing, I could have a lot more fun. It was a lot more social, and I could go and compete in a state level event or a national level event and go quite well. Whereas swimming, you know, you're killing yourself day after day. And, you know, if you missed a week of training and turned up at an event, you know, you were out the back, kind of thing. So I don't want to say sailing was the easy option, but it was definitely the more social and the, you know, the more fun option, you know, when I had to make the decision whether to kind of carry on with swimming or kind of divert my focus to sailing. It was a pretty easy decision to take the one that I really enjoyed, and it was a lot more social and I had more fun with my friends.
Yeah, that sounds like the right decision to me. I also did some county level swimming when I was a kid as well, and I remember it was just a grind. I enjoyed the competitions, but the training really, really was a grind, and there was no kind of upside to that. I wonder, did you take any sort of any of the ethos of you know, the discipline of training from that into your sailing, maybe later in your career?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think you know, looking back on it, probably the first time I really, you know, took sailing seriously was I went and competed in the Youth Worlds with Evan Walker, who I did almost all of my junior sailing with. And Evan was living in Sydney and I was living at Lake Macquarie, and it was in the class was, it was the multi-hull, was the Hobie 16 was the youth boat. And we'd only just jumped in the boat for the trials to try and, you know, get a spot. And so we had no experience in these boats. And I guess for a 6 month period, we kind of took that swimming style training approach to our sailing and, you know, just logged so many hours and, you know, and it was kind of a good, you know, I guess to translate those, that swimming discipline into sailing for the first time. And then as a result, we ended up winning the event, and it was, you know, I guess it was quite rewarding to see, you know, oh yeah, you do put in the effort and you do put in the hard work. It really will pay off. And that was when I was 15 or 16 to, I think it was quite nice to see that it can work in sailing as well.
Was that untypical of people's approach, you know, people of your age's approach to racing at that point, or were other people, you know, also taking that approach?
I mean, I think one thing that was different with Evan and I is we jumped in a new class, which was not very common, I guess, and especially a multi-hull as well, because at the time, I guess there was a big division between multi-hull sailors and monohull sailors, which I guess no longer exists today with, you know, the America's Cup and Sail GP and whatever. But back then it was like, oh, multi-hull sailors, you know, you can't do that or whatever. And so I think it was probably uncommon for people to go and try something radically different like we did, and also to, you know, really put the time in to learn, you know, from people who have different experiences from you and to be successful. So, yeah, I guess it was a little bit of a different approach that we had.
And what were some of the other classes that you progressed through in your early sailing career there? I've seen lasers and I've seen 49ers dotted around on your kind of ISAF biography.
So I grew up in the Sabo and then the Flying Ant, which is there's actually a lot of really good sailors who have come from the Flying Ant, and it's Adam Beischel is doing a really good job in Australia kind of re-energizing the class, and it's a small skiff, two-person skiff, Flying Ants, 29ers, and then the multi-hull with Evan, and then lasers for a few years where unfortunately I wasn't very good and I really didn't enjoy it. A lot of youth match racing, a couple of seasons on the 18-foot skiff, and I guess that was, you know, with the dinghy experience, you know, kind of had the, you know, an eye on the Olympics. And Evan, who I did my youth sailing with, we got invited to the Tornado Worlds in Portugal in 2007 with the idea of doing a campaign for London 2012. And it was very shortly after that the Tornado got axed from the Olympics, and so did our ambition to try for the Olympics. And that's when I kind of switched my focus to match racing and the America's Cup, and really decided that that's really what I wanted to do, and the best avenue to achieve that would be to try and be successful in the World Match Racing Tour.
And that, in Australia, match racing is still it's a big part of sailing. It's a big element, a discipline of sailing, isn't it? Perhaps more so than in other parts of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I was very fortunate that I was a member of the Cruising Yacht Club of Australia. They've got a really good youth program. And so I, living at Lake Macquarie and growing up there, I travel to Sydney every weekend, which is a two-hour drive, to attend this youth squad and youth match racing. And there's a couple of clubs around Sydney that, and also in Western Australia, that kind of have these programs. And so there's quite a good youth circuit. And of course, you know, as young keen sailors, we're kind of focusing and watching what's happening in Europe with these big events, you know, with that ultimately being the goal to go and compete in those and kind of, I guess, doing the groundwork with the youth events in Sydney and Australia, and New Zealand, sorry.
And what was your role in the match racing team?
Well, it kind of varied. When I first started, I was the youngest person at the youth program, and I remember my dad said to me, he's like, you know, everybody wants to be a skipper, but there's only going to be one skipper at you know, selected to go to each event. And he's like, if you really want to, you know, go and do these international events, you know, maybe your best avenue is to become a really invaluable crew and be really good on board. And so my first role was a bowman on the Elliott Sixes, which is not really like a typical bowman, I guess. It's just a, you know, you pull the spinnaker up and down, but they're not that big and it's not that hard. So I was bowman, and then I guess as I got more experience, I started sliding a little further aft and kind of found my position on the main. And then a couple of years later, you know, after doing all the youth stuff, Torvar Mirsky and Keith Swinton were headed over to Europe, and they asked me if I'd like to join their teams, you know, trying to make a career out of mat racing, and if I'd like to come and sail with them. And so I joined them as a mainsail trimmer / tactician for the, I guess, the lower level mat racing events until we kind of increased our ranking and got a bit better and, you know, got selected to compete in the World Mat Racing Tour.
And that's, Torvar's been a guest on the podcast as well, and we covered quite a lot of this with him, but the World Mat Racing Tour really is the bedrock of the kind of access to professional sailing if you're coming in through the mat racing route, hasn't it? It's been around for so long, and it's still going pretty strong.
Yeah, absolutely. And at the time, it was in 2008 that I first went to Europe. So multi-hull, you know, America's Cup or foiling America's Cup, you know, didn't exist. So at the time, it was like, yeah, wow, this is the most relevant, you know, thing we can do, and we can turn up to one of these events and race against five or six America's Cup skippers. So for us, that was really the, you know, the ultimate way to get involved. And I guess the great thing about the mat racing circuit is that you can, you know, enter as a young team, and it's relatively cheap. You just really have to get yourself there. You don't have to buy a boat or, you know, have the most expensive tools. You know, you just need to get you and your team to an event, and then you have an equal opportunity to win and race against the best. So for us, it was a very economical way of doing some very high-level racing with our mates and with the team that we wanted to sail with.
And aside from all of that, what an amazing adventure for you to come from Australia to Europe with your mates and be, you know, be competing in a major league sporting event.
Yeah, well, I mean, it wasn't all good times. I mean, when we were at regattas, that was the best thing, because typically they'd pay for your accommodation and you'd get breakfast at, you know, at the events and lunch and maybe dinner if you're lucky. But I guess the toughest thing was in between events, and being from Australia, you know, we didn't have anywhere to live in Europe. So we were just kind of, you know, somebody would say, oh, yeah, you can come and stay with us for a couple of days. And being Australians, you know, we would take them up on that, and we would exhaust our invitation until we're basically asked to leave. But it was basically, you know, we didn't have the money to support ourselves outside of these events, and any money that we did have, it would be invested into doing some training to try and upskill and make ourselves better, so we had a higher percentage chance of, you know, achieving our goal of becoming professional sailors.
So you would be away for a few weeks at a time, or would it be the whole summer, or how would it work?
Yeah, months. It was typically leave Australia in April and come back in October or so. So, yeah, we were away for a significant portion of the year. You know, but I think that's ultimately what, you know, from my point of view, that's really what you need to do. If you want to achieve your goal, you need to be in 100%. You know, you can't be going back home and, you know, focusing on other things, because, you know, that just serves as a distraction. You need to be all in, and you know, and if you do really invest the time and really want to do it, it will work out, and you'll find a way to make it happen.
So by this stage, the goal was to become a professional sailor, to make your career on the professional yacht racing circuit.
Yeah, the goal was really the America's Cup, and to get into that via the World Mat Racing Tour. You know, we were young, we were reasonably good, and, you know, these America's Cup sailors would turn up at some of these events and we would beat them. And we would be like, well, you know, give us the keys to your cup team. You know, we're good enough to do it. And it wasn't until I went and did some other sailing that I realized how little we actually knew, you know, and that we were actually just quite good at mat racing. But in terms of the whole picture of sailing, you know, there was still a lot to learn. But, you know, at the time we thought we had what it took.
Yeah, you were the young guns, and I guess you came over with a bit of bluster because you had to, really.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we really believed that we were good enough, and we had some good results. But I guess that's the beauty of sailing, is there's so many different disciplines, and, you know, it was a lot of the, you know, with us being a young team, it was a big case of we didn't know what we didn't know. You know, there was, you know, so many subtle things when it comes to trimming and development and, you know, a whole different side of sailing that we had no idea about until we kind of did some other sailing and realised, like, wow, we still have a lot to learn.
And back home in Australia, were your parents and your family supportive of this, or were they a little bit sketchy about the whole thing?
I remember because I didn't go to university. I, you know, like I was saying before, I kind of believed that, you know, to make the sailing work, I needed to invest 100% of my time and energy into doing that. And I didn't want to have the distraction of having to try and study at the same time. And I think, you know, my parents were maybe a little reluctant to see me kind of pass up my university offer. But, you know, they were, you know, the ones who really pushed me to do it as well. You know, they said, yeah, okay, well, you know, give it a couple of years and, you know, if you make it, you make it. And if not, you can always come back to uni. You know, you don't need a fallback plan. You're still going to be young in a couple of years and you can make it work. So, yeah, no, they were really supportive. And, yeah, fortunately, I didn't have to go back to uni.
So did you emerge from that experience, that European tours, a different person? Could you notice a difference in yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I became a lot more organized, and people who know me well probably still don't think I'm very organized, but, you know, if I have improved my organizational skills, then that's a I've come a long way. Because I just remember, you know, going to these events early in Europe and, you know, never having to look after myself, always living at home, and then suddenly you're on the other side of the world, and you've got to look, you know, you've got to do your washing, you've got to do your cleaning, your cooking, you know, your logistics, you've got to figure out how to get yourself from A to B to these different events. And so I guess you learn a lot of skills, you know, with how to look after yourself pretty quickly, and also how to manage your, you know, your time and your opportunities that you get, and, you know, to make sure you're always kind of trying to fill the calendar and bounce from event to event. So yeah, a lot of logistical lessons were learnt, and also just how to look after myself.
And were you establishing yourselves individually now as names, you know, in this match racing world? Because as much as anything, if you want to break in, people have got to know who you are, right? So you've got to be getting some results, you've got to be getting some face time with some of the bigger names who've got some influence in the sport.
Yeah, well, our goal was, the biggest strength of our team was our team, I think. You know, we all worked really, really well together, and, you know, the goal was that we wanted to be employed by an America's Cup team, but we all wanted to do it together.
Right.
And so, you know, we really tried to stick together and help each other out when it came to, you know, various opportunities that came about. And I think just the nature of our results, you know, and that the World Map Tracing Tour was getting some good publicity. We got just a random email from Jimmy Spithill saying, you know, nice work, guys, keep up the good work, kind of thing, you know, as he, you know, kind of cut his teeth in the World Map Tracing Tour as well. You know, he just saw these young Aussies giving it a crack and doing well. So he just sent us an email saying, nice work, kind of thing. And we were all, you know, stoked. We're like, oh, you know, Jimmy Spithill, you know, an email from him. Like, wow, you know, like, you know, we're kind of being recognized, which was a nice a feeling to kind of be recognized by someone, you know, of his caliber. And then fortunately, he, you know, a few emails went back and forth between our guys, you know, our team and Jimmy, and he said, hey, look, I've got an opening for an amateur on an RC44, you know, are any of you guys interested? And fortunately, at the time, I was the only amateur by their ISAF rankings on our team. So I got to go and sail with Jimmy and the Oracle guys on the RC44. And that kind of all came about through the World Map Tracing Tour and through us getting a bit of recognition and Jimmy just noticing, you know, that we're out there kind of giving it a crack.
Wow. So that, and just to check that, the reason you were an amateur, was it because you were under a certain age or?
Yeah, I was 21 at the time or 20 maybe. And I think the rules were you had to be under 24 to be an amateur. And the hard thing with the map tracing as well is that, you know, the other guys on the team were classified as professionals, but we weren't really earning an income from the sailing. We were just, you know, we were winning reasonable amounts of prize money, but all of that money was just invested back in the team to cover our expenses, to cover our training. And so if you look at all of our bank accounts, they all still read zero, you know, despite, you know, potentially getting a good payday in an event. And so, I mean, that amateur status and rule, you know, I was very, very fortunate that, you know, I got that opportunity, but it's also a bit of a shame that the other guys, you know, who I was racing with at the time didn't get that because of the way that the amateur rule was interpreted or, you know, the way that the rule was written. So, yeah, I was quite lucky to get that chance to go and race with Jimmy.
So I want to ask you about that experience on the RC44 with Jimmy, but what happened then with the team? Did you go back to Torvar and the boys? And were you with Torvar when he won the Worlds or no?
No, I wasn't. No, so I think this was 2011, actually. I started sailing with Jimmy on the 44 and I'd done the tour with Torvar 2008, 9, 10, 11. Yeah, maybe we wrapped it up in 2012, I think. And then Torvar took a bit of a hiatus from sailing, which was about the time that we all kind of went and did, you know, focused on different projects.
Uh-huh. So let's go back to the RC44. It's a great opportunity, but also it must have been a little bit daunting because that crew you're walking into, it's a mix of pros and amateurs, but even the amateurs are bloody good, aren't they? So who were you joining on that crew other than Jimmy?
So Jimmy was the tactician, and then we had Joey Newton trimming, Pete Van Nieuwenhuizen on the bow, and Brad Webb. They were switching. So both, you know, guru bowmen, and then Skip Baxter on the mainsail. And then the amateurs were, you know, I mean, I would have said they're pros, you know, they were so good, you know, all the amateurs on board as well. So I was clearly the weak link. And, you know, coming from the mat tracing circuit where, you know, we had so much confidence when we were mat tracing, you know, we felt, you know, like we could beat anybody and we had the best boat handling, to suddenly jumping on a boat with a pedestal. I'd never been on a boat with a grinding pedestal, you know, and these different systems, which were, you know, when I look at it now, it's very simple, but at the time I had no experience in a boat like that. So everything was quite complicated and I didn't fully understand how things worked. And it was just so different. And I remember, and I'd never drop hiked either, which is a big part of the RC44. And I remember we pushed out of the dock, off the dock in Valencia for the first sail. And I went to hike and I said to the guy next to me, I was like, mate, how do I get back in? You know, so I'm drop hiking over the side of the boat. And he's like, he explained it, but I didn't fully understand, but I was a bit too, you know, embarrassed to admit I didn't know. So I hear the standby call tack and I'm like scrambling to get into the boat and ended up getting picked up by the chase boat and dropped back on the boat.
Oh, wow. Not the most auspicious of starts then.
No, so the very first tack, I was in the water and, you know, and all the guys kind of laughed it off and, you know, I was thinking, oh, no, this is so embarrassing. Like, I know I've got a lot more to give than this. And then it must have been the first or second day I was doing offside trim and Joey Newton, who's a really, really nice guy, he's like, okay, the one thing you can't do is back the Genoa. You know, when you're letting the jib off an attack, you just got to let it off early. Don't hold it on too late. And anyway, we're doing some mat tracing practice against the other boat and we had a bit of a hard tack bear away. And I was like, oh, yeah, I've got to hold the jib, you know, forgot the number one rule of letting the Genoa off early and thinking, you know, we've got to try and get the bow down out of this tack. So we went to tack and I held the jib on, you know, thinking I was helping out by dragging the bow down through the tack, and ended up putting a massive hole in the sail as the spreader poked through it and jib down, you know, sail makers on board trying to fix the thing. And I was in a hell of a state, you know, thinking, what do these guys think?
Wow. Those boats are 44 feet long, but I bet there was nowhere to hide, was there?
No, I was so embarrassed. And I was like, oh no, you know, what have I done? They're never going to ask me to come back again. And fortunately, they, for some reason, they persevered with me and stuck the season out.
Wow. I mean, that's a baptism of fire. For those people who don't know who are listening, just describe the RC44 a little bit, because they're quite an unusual boat, aren't they?
Yeah, so the RC44, it's a 44-foot yacht. It's got two wheels, one grinding pedestal, an asymmetrical spinnaker with a retractable pole. It's got some running backstays, and you race with eight people. But I think the one thing that's really unique about it is when you're sailing in a straight line, every single one of the eight people on board basically has a control line or a rope in their hand, which can really affect the performance of the boat. So I was the offside trimmer. So all I was doing was, you know, when we're tacking, I was letting the jib off, and, you know, Joey, as the trimmer, was pulling it on. But in a straight line, I had the jib car in my hand, you know, so every time there was a gust, you know, it required me to actually contribute and kind of think about it. So, you know, there's eight people on board, but there's no rail meet. Everybody's kind of drop hiking over the side of the boat, but everybody is also really tuned into the performance. So as a team boat, I think it's actually the best boat to sail in the world, because it really requires everyone on board to be completely switched on, and there's no passengers basically. So it's a very rewarding boat to be racing, and you know, as I alluded to, you kind of got to be onto it. You can't just be a hack who kind of falls overboard or backs the sail into the mast.
Yeah, it's not the first time I've heard this from the pros, that they really love the RC44. And you talk about drop hiking, and you've explained that a little bit, but when I watched the RC44s for the first time, it just felt like everybody was just hanging on by their fingernails. I mean, that's what it looks like from off the boat. And so I feel for you when you realize you couldn't physically get back on the boat, because it would be very easy to get in that position.
Yeah, it is.
So you survived that regatta. How did you get on in the regatta?
I can't remember how we went in the first one, but we were kind of mixing it up there, and then we ended up, winning a few events. We ended up winning the World Championships that year in both the fleet racing and the mat racing, and so the team was working really, really well together, and believe it or not, I managed to learn how to, you know, do my job on board, and felt like I was starting to contribute to the team and help out, and so in the end we were quite successful as a team and had a lot of fun on the way.
So I've got to ask you, you're sailing with Jimmy. What did you, because you sailed with Jimmy a lot over the years now, but that first experience of it, maybe that first season, what did you see in him? You must have been like a sponge trying to absorb all of the kind of professional attitude of these guys. What did you see in Jimmy that you really remember?
Well, what I was really surprised about is, you know, when I jumped on board, I was 20 years old, you know, pretty inexperienced, you know, obviously had a small bit of success in the World Mat Racing Tour, but, you know, in terms of sailing, you know, I kind of really had no idea. But one thing I was really impressed with is just how all the old guys, all the professional guys, and also the amateurs on board as well, you know, they really asked for my opinion on things, and whether, you know, they were just doing it to be nice, or they really thought that, you know, my opinion was worth listening to. You know, they really just got everybody involved, and you know, just their attitude and the way that they, treated their teammates, it really made you feel like you're a part of it. You know, and even if the information I was giving was not really that important or that relevant, it really made me feel important and feel like I was a part of the team. And I think that's one thing I really learned from these guys, is just how they're such team players and they're not selfish. You know, when they make a mistake, they'll put their hand up and say, hey, my bad, you know, and we can learn from it. But just their attitude was that was huge for me, you know, and also just seeing how calm they are all the time. There was never any yelling or screaming. It was just calm, you know, and as we're seeing in the America's Cup now, you know, you watch all of the guys racing on, you know, on almost all the teams. There's no yelling and screaming. It's all calm, clinical, and, you know, they're kind of bouncing ideas off each other. And that's kind of really the first time I'd, you know, witnessed somebody who had so much more experience than me, you know, who was just really trying to figure out what I thought and you know, including me in the team. So that was, it was pretty nice.
Is that something you've managed to replicate yourself with other younger sailors that you've sailed with?
Yeah, I mean, I guess in terms of professional sailors, I'm still quite young. And I actually haven't sailed with that many people who are too much younger than me. But, yeah, for sure, that's what I whether I do it or not, it's certainly something I try to do and try and, you know, listen to other people and, you know, because ultimately, you know, you're only as strong as your weakest link in these teams. And, you know, you really need everybody to be at the same level and you need to, you know, get people to be fully invested in these teams and what you're doing. And because for a lot of people, it's a big sacrifice to go and, you know, try and become a professional sailor or to, you know, compete in these professional sailing teams. You know, it takes a big sacrifice. So you need people who are really invested in it and want to do it.
And were you learning from these other guys kind of about the life of a professional sailor as well? Because I guess, you know, off the boat, you get to hang out with them, you get to talk to them, you get some sort of relationship going with them. Were you getting a bigger picture of the potential there?
Yeah, well, I remember the first event, the first time I joined those guys, and it's really the first kind of professional sailing that I'd been involved in was the RC44. And even though I was an amateur, but, you know, being surrounded by those guys, and I remember thinking, you know, on the first night, I was like, okay, so where are we going for dinner? You know, and everybody kind of split off and did their own thing. And I remember thinking, oh, this is a bit strange, because on the mat racing circuit, you know, we have breakfast, lunch and dinner together and we probably are sharing the same bed as well. So we're together 24/7 and then suddenly, you know, to join these bigger teams, and it was a bit more, you know, I kind of realized pretty quickly that, you know, this is actually a job for these guys as well. You know, they're doing it, you know, every day of the year. And, you know, to be able to maintain a good relationship with each other, you can't be spending every single second of every day together. And, you know, I think they quickly realized that I was getting bored pretty quickly by myself. So they kind of tagged me along. But, yeah, it was definitely a different feeling, you know, being the young guys on circuit and, you know, sleeping on people's couches to suddenly staying in nice hotels and, you know, you're a little bit more removed from the social scene, and it is a bit more professional, and it's more about the racing than, you know, kind of hanging out with each other afterwards and, you know, playing cards or whatever it was that we did. But yeah, it was a different vibe for sure.
Did you discover any weaknesses in your kind of makeup, your ability, your skills? Was there anything you thought, wow, I really need to beef up on this side of my ability?
Yeah, well, I think one thing with the mat racing is you become really, really good at racing, and you really know, you know, all the moves and all the playbooks inside and out. But probably the biggest thing that I was missing was just the, I guess, the development side and being able to identify, you know, looking at a sail, is that a good sail shape or is it not, you know? And I think, you know, our team, we had really good feeling, but we probably didn't really know the science behind the feeling. And that's one thing, you know, jumping on the 44s where you can design your own sails and the boats are a bit more technical. I was like, okay, well, you know, if I want to call myself a mainsail trimmer, I've got a lot to learn. And so, you know, joining those guys and learning from them, that was huge, just seeing how they operate.
So the end of that season, you win the World Championships, and then what happens next? Does everybody shake you by the hand and say, great sailing with you, see you again sometime? What happened next?
Well, yeah, so during that season, Oracle decided to have the America's Cup in multi-hulls, and And I remember thinking at the time, like, oh, what a stupid decision. You know, we've been working for years, you know, trying to build up our ranking in the World Match Racing Tour. You know, we want it to be in Monohulls. We feel like, you know, somebody could just grab us tomorrow and we could, you know, we could go and do the job kind of thing. So when it shifted to multi-hulls, you know, it was a bit disheartening because it's like, oh, you know, their goal is still to do the cup, but, you know, we don't have any, you know, big boat multi experience, and we're suddenly, you know, back to square one, you know, so we need to kind of retrain again. And I had developed a good relationship with Jimmy over the season, and you know, we talked very loosely about the cup, and he obviously knew that I was desperate to do it. So he kind of, I don't know whether he was dangling the carrot or whatever, but he was like, yeah, yeah, no, well, let's stay in touch about the cup. You know, we need some young guys, you know, blah, blah, blah. So he was kind of loosely staying in touch about it, you know, after the season concluded. But, you know, as the match racing team, you know, like I said, we wanted to all kind of do it together. And so we said, okay, we need to refocus. And so as a result, we jumped in and did the Extreme Sailing Series, and Torva and I jumped on a team for the year, and Kinley also jumped in another team, and Graham as well. So we all kind of split off and did the Extreme Sailing Series just to try and retrain and reskill to kind of make ourselves more attractive for these cup teams who are suddenly looking for multi-hull sailors. And I guess somewhere through that year, I'd kind of stayed in contact with Jimmy, and he offered for me to join Oracle for that upcoming America's Cup in the multi-hull. So I was on my way.
Wow. That, I mean, you say it quite casually and modestly, but that must have been a huge moment, was it? Was it a phone call, an email?
Yeah, well, it was I actually went and did a trial with Artemis, because when we were doing the Extreme Sailing Series, Artemis were also racing, and so I kind of got to know the guys, and they said, you know, why don't you come and do a trial with us, and you know, see how you go, and that was kind of what gave Jimmy a bit of a sense of urgency that. You know, I kind of went back to him and said, oh, mate, you know, I'm going to do this with Artemis. And he's like, Jimmy's like, okay, you know what, we'll take you kind of thing. and that, for me, that was a huge relief. You know, I was like, you know, trying to, you know, I was talking to Terry, you know, with Artemis, and then talking to Jimmy with Oracle. And I kind of just sat back and was like, wow, you know, is this really happening kind of thing? And, you know, I think it was a big case of right place, right time, you know, that I was able to kind of have those two opportunities. And, yeah, Jimmy just kind of said, you know, come with us, mate, you know, and I'd had that relationship with him and also the guys throughout the RC44 season the year before, and so it was kind of an easy choice to join them, and yeah, quite was very lucky.
Yeah, well, I don't think it doesn't sound like there's luck involved, but I take your point. And so now stepping into an America's Cup team, I would imagine is another huge step up in terms of the level of professionalism and just everything. What was that like?
Yeah, I mean, if I thought the RC44, I was out of my depth, you know, the cup team and joining Oracle was just at another level. And, you know, I remember turning up in San Francisco for my first day, and it was a testing session, and it must have been October 2011 or so. Yeah, when I first sailed with them on the AC45, sorry, and I remember I kind of badgered Jimmy a bit about what position I was going to be doing, and he's like, "Oh, well, mate, you know, we just need some good sailors who can kind of do anything. You know, we just need you to. We basically just want good sailors." And I was like, "Okay, well, that doesn't tell me anything. You know, am I going to be the bowman? Am I going to be a grinder? You know, like where am I going to be, kind of thing?" And so I was a little bit nervous about where I was going to be positioned in the team, you know, not really wanting, you know, and I had a kind of an idea of what I wanted, and that was to be a mainsail trimmer or a wing trimmer. And anyway, the first day they put me on the bow, and I was so rubbish, you know. I remember I was out sailing, and I was 21 in 2011, and then had Matt Mitchell, who's an America's Cup winning bowman, you know, he was kind of helping me out, you know, and I just remember him looking at me, and I could basically read his thoughts. You know, he was just thinking, this kid is useless. and basically, you know, throughout that 2 or 3 week training session, they kind of, after each sail, they just kind of slid me further and further back in the boat until I got to the wing, and then like, oh, okay, yeah, you know what, he's not too bad at this. We'll leave him here.
Wow. It's almost hard to believe that that's how it works, you know, because, you know, obviously now you've made your name as the America's Cup winning wing trimmer, and we'll talk about some of the circumstances behind that in a sec. But, yeah, to imagine that it's like, well, let's just see how he is on the bow. Well, no, he's no good at that, so.
Yeah, well, I think that America's Cup as well was quite unique, you know, and nobody really – I guess it was a lot of monohull sailors learning the multi-hulls, and you know, the foiling was only just being introduced. And I remember so clearly, we, you know, during that training session, we had one boat with rudder elevators on, like winglets on the foil, on the rudder foil, and the other boat without it. And we did that, and I remember somebody said so conclusively, like, you know, the boat with the foils on the rudder is going to be so much slower upwind. You know, why are we wasting our time testing this? And, you know, and that's kind of how far back, you know, it's easy to forget how quickly everything's progressed. But I just remember somebody saying, you know, like, what a waste of time this is, you know, to test these foils on the rudder. Like, it's going to be so much slower upwind, you know, dragging these rudder elevators through the water. And then, you know, you fast forward a year from then, or, you know, until now, and, you know, you couldn't even imagine boats, you know, like that, not foiling. So it was a big eye opener, just to, you know, you got to keep your mind open to anything. And, you know, somebody I remember said to me, which really stuck with me, is, you know, the idea that's going to win the America's Cup, you know, nobody's thought of that yet. And, you know, early on in the campaign, which really forced you to be like, wow, you know, we need to have kind of out of the box thinking, and to be involved with, I guess, so many creative people in the design team and sailing team and shore guys. It was, yeah, it was a baptism of fire, and I guess a bit of a university education in sailing, I guess.
Yeah. Am I right in thinking you had Darren Bundock involved in the team, kind of helping teach you about, or helping teach the team about multi-hulls, or did I get that wrong?
No, yeah, Bundy was on the team. And so he was driving, well, he spent a lot of the time driving the other AC-45, the test boat, and also some racing against Jimmy. Yeah, so he was kind of the resident multi-hull expert.
Okay, yeah. So at least another Australian around there as well to give you a familiar accent. And I guess Tom was there too, right?
Yeah, there was actually quite a lot of Australians on that team. So it was, although I hadn't really worked or, you know, known many of them, it was quite comforting to have, you know, so many like-minded people and, you know, similar culture to kind of help us out, you know, when I was learning the ropes.
How long did it take you before you felt like you weren't the new kid in that team?
When I signed up, Simeon was the next youngest, and he's 10 years older than me. So it took, probably some time before the next young person came in, which I think was Rome Kirby, and that was maybe 6 or 9 months afterwards. So I felt like the young kid for quite some time, until I guess the other young guys turned up, and then we kind of banded together a little bit, and, you know, we all have a really good friendship and relationship. So it took a while. But I mean, I think, you know, in the eyes of the older guys, you know, we were always the young guys, and, you know, they were always, you know, not giving us a hard time, but I guess pushing us, which I think is what we needed, you know, to be pushed and I guess guided in a way, so we kind of maximize our learning.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I'm guessing, I wanted to ask you if you were on board the boat when it capsized before the America's Cup, the Oracle boat. Were you on that boat then, or were you part of the?
No, really? I was. Yeah, I was. So as the, I guess it was kind of when we launched the AC-72, it was decided that Dirk de Ridder, he was the number one wing trimmer, and I was the backup. But we had a plan to do some two bike testing, so it was important that as the backup or as the second trimmer, I got some experience. So it was day eight that we capsized. But in the days leading up to that, Dirk had been doing some sailing, and then he'd been kind of letting me sail, and he was kind of sitting next to me, kind of passing his knowledge on. And he was the wing trimmer for the trimaran as well, so he had quite a lot of wing experience and was heavily involved in the design and development of the wings as well. So he was, I guess, instrumental in me learning. And I guess the day that we capsized, Dirk was like, "Oh yeah, I'll do another run, and you know, then you jump on and trim for a couple of laps." And it was in the, you know, in his last lap, and also our last lap in the out in the bay, that we went for this bear away, and I was just sitting on the net as a spectator. You know, we started to capsize, and I was just like, "Oh no, this is going bad."
Yeah. Had you guys conceived of capsizing that boat at that point, or was it just too horrific a prospect?
Not really. I mean, I think everybody knew it was a possibility, but I guess it, you know, that kind of thing hadn't really, a boat like that hadn't been built before, and you know, we weren't expecting to kind of send it in big seas, I guess, like the Amoka 60, which is probably the only, Orma 60, sorry, which was probably the only comparable boat at that time. You know, so I think we felt relatively safe being inside the Golden Gate Bridge and in the bay there, you know, and I mean, I certainly didn't think it was going to happen until I saw the tip of the wing hit the water.
Yeah. I mean, I just remember hearing the news reports come back. I mean, we were in San Francisco when it happened, but it, you know, it was hard to understand what was happening. It was hard to get your head around it. The boat basically came back in pieces. Was that, I mean, did you think, wow, this might be all over at this point?
Yeah. I don't think anyone in the team was probably really thinking about the long-term, you know, the long-term effects at the time, you know. And I remember going home that night, or, you know, that early the next morning, whenever we got back to the dock at 4 a.m. or whenever it was, you know, and just thinking like, wow, you know, what just happened, you know. You know, I wasn't really thinking about what's going to happen in the campaign, because we still had boat two being constructed in the shed at that point. So, you know, the campaign was going to carry on, but it was, you know, it was a huge wake-up call, I think, for our team, and also for the America's Cup and that format of racing, is just to how seriously you need to take safety, and how much, I guess, we had neglected it at that point, even though we thought we'd been doing a, you know, a reasonable job at it.
Yeah. Now, I want to fast forward a little bit to just before the Cup, and there was, you know, obviously the famous incident problem issue with points being deducted from the team due to some shenanigans, let's call it that, that the team was accused of with the AC-45s. I don't particularly want to get into asking you all about that, but it ended up with Dirk de Ridder kind of being sidelined and taking the blame for that, and you became the de facto, you were the standard main sheet trimmer, so you suddenly were the main sheet trimmer.
Can yeah.
you talk a little bit about that time, though, and just from your own point of view?
I mean, it was I think, you know, if you're preparing to defend the America's Cup, it's probably the worst possible thing to happen to a team, you know, regardless of the outcome and who sails and what happens. But just to have such a big distraction to the whole team in the weeks leading up to racing is, I mean, it was tough. So, you know, Dirk got banned, which meant that I was on board, and you know, and just kind of thrown into the deep end, I guess. And, you know, as a 24-year-old, I was, you know, pretty self-confident and self-assured, you know, and I was like, you know, I can do this, no problem, kind of thing. And you know, felt, you know, I guess I had that inner belief that I could do the job. But, you know, when you look around and you see all these, you know, sailing legends on the team, you know, you start to doubt your own ability a little bit, I guess. And so for sure I was nervous, and it was a, you know, a hugely turbulent lead up to the Cup. And, you know, I was like, okay, shit, you know, now's the time I've got to really step it up and, you know, make sure that I'm doing the best job that I can do. And fortunately, Dirk, I guess he, throughout that whole campaign, he was really the person in the team that kind of took me under his wing and, you know, made sure that whenever there was a meeting happening, you know, I was included, I was CC'd in all the emails, when, you know, to do with the wing and everything. So he'd done a really good job of really including me and training me up. So when this happened, you know, it was a big change and it was very unexpected. But, you know, I guess due to his help, I actually felt quite prepared to do the role on board.
How did you feel for him at that point? Because it was a crushing blow, wasn't it, for Dirk?
Yeah, I mean, I'm really good friends with Dirk. And, yeah, I mean, it was devastating for him and also, I guess, for all of us, you know, without getting into to too much detail about it. You know, he was really instrumental in that America's Cup, in the boat being how it was, and I guess the ultimate performance of the boat. You know, he's largely responsible for that, for the work that he'd done in the years leading up to that point. So it was really devastating for him to not be able to compete and to be able to see it through to the end. But on the other hand, it was selfishly, it was a really great opportunity for me to jump on board.
Yeah, and again, you get these amazing opportunities, but with it comes such massive pressure and massive responsibility. I remember being in the media center and just, you know, watching your face on the onboard cameras and stuff as the team was kind of getting ready for that first set of races. And I mean, you. I don't want to be rude, but you look terrified at that point.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's no lie. I mean, before the racing, for sure, you know, in the whole lead up, I was incredibly nervous. And I mean, I've watched the racing since, and I still look, you know, terrified, I think, even in the racing. But I think at least in my mind, as soon as we entered for the first pre-start, you know, I was like, okay, you know, I know what to focus on now. And all of the distractions of the choppers overhead and the, you know, thousands of boats out on the water, that kind of disappeared. And, you know, it just came back to simple sailing again. And I knew my job that I had to do. And, you know, and that's the only thing I really needed to focus on. So, yeah, despite maybe what the images appear, I actually felt quite confident and quite, I guess, more relaxed as soon as we started racing. But for sure, you know, leading up to the first race, I was absolutely, you know, terrified, I guess, you know, having, I guess, being in such a key position on board, you know, the youngest person on the team, the most inexperienced on the team, you know, in a key role that probably has quite a bit of an effect over the performance of the boat as well. I was like, you know, if I, you know, I'm not performing here, if I make mistakes, it's going to cost us races. And, you know, we've had a team of 200 people investing 3 or 4 years of their lives to this, and if I, you know, make a mistake, you know, all their work is for nothing, kind of thing. So there were the kind of things going through my head before the first race, which is probably not the ideal the ideal setup.
Did Jimmy give you any sort of mentoring guidance, any, you know, anything kind of notable at that point?
Not really, not that I can think of, but, you know, he was always like, oh, you know, you'll be right, mate. You know, just keep doing what you're doing, kind of thing. Like he's always so relaxed, and I think, you know, at the beginning you can kind of think, oh yeah, you know, he's just saying that. But then when he really leads by example, you know, with that kind of approach, and he's always relaxed no matter whether you're winning or losing. He's, you know, I've sailed with him for, you know, almost every day for 6 years, and he never once yelled at me or swore at me for making a mistake. And trust me, I've made plenty. And so I think, you know, having somebody like that sitting next to you who, you know, is so calm and self-assured, it actually gives you confidence that, you know, you can kind of, you know, do the same thing.
He is a phenomenon. Just the America's Cup that's going on right now, when they show the heart meters, he struggles to break 85 most of the time when everybody else is up near 100 or something, you know, in the afterguard.
Yeah, well, actually in Bermuda during the Cup, you know, we all had the heart rate monitors on, and we would often have, you know, if if Jimmy or myself, if our heart rate ever got above 100, you know, we'd always give the other person a hard time because it's like, what are you stressed out for, mate? You know, you've got to relax kind of thing. So I'm sure they're looking at that heart rate data as well. And if Jimmy ever sees himself spike above 80, he'll be annoyed at himself for getting worked up.
That's great insight. That's great insight. Now, it was a long America's Cup, and we all know how the results came at the end. We don't really have time to get into all of that, but I do want to ask you, you must have been at some point thinking, I am actually living my dream here. It might not be just the way I thought it was going to turn out, but I'm at the America's Cup and I'm trimming main sheet, and you know, we're in the hunt to win this. What did it feel like when you realized you'd won the America's Cup?
I mean, for me, the first goal was always to, you know, be involved in the America's Cup, and the goal of winning didn't really kind of come in until I had joined a team and, you know, kind of, you know, ticked that first box, I guess. And then so to, you know, to win it on the first attempt, I was just like, you know, what's going on here? You know, yeah. this is the peak kind of thing. And, you know, so it was, yeah, amazing feeling. Like it's hard to describe. And I'd say probably the most rewarding thing is, you know, celebrating with your teammates the night after, and also your family and friends who are there supporting you, and just knowing the sacrifice that every single person on the team has put in to achieve that goal. You know, because when you're watching on the TV, you only see the sailors on the boat, and you know, it's really easy to forget, you know, the hundreds of people that are behind the scenes to kind of make it happen. And so to be able to celebrate with those people was, you know, it's something that you only get to do once in your life, or, you know, if you're lucky, a few more times.
Well, you did get to do it again. You got to try again in Bermuda. So was it pretty much followed on from the other? Did you get to go back to Australia, or what? How did that all play out?
Yeah, after San Francisco, went back to Australia for a few months, but then we basically rolled straight into the next campaign. It was only a short break before we were kind of back into it again, and it was a very different looking team for Bermuda. We had quite a young team, and that was quite a conscious decision by Russell, who was the CEO of the team, to really have a young team. And, you know, he was kind of saying that, you know, you young guys are the future of the sport, and you know, it's a different game now. It's no longer the version 5 monohull map tracing. It's a fast paced game. You need to be young, and so it was a very different makeup for the second time around in Bermuda.
It didn't work out for you in Bermuda. Did you come away from that with massive regrets about anything, or do you feel like you kind of left it all on the table, as they say? Left it all out on the water, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, hindsight's a wonderful thing. You know, looking back on it, you know, there's hundreds of things that we could have done better or been more effective at. But, I mean, ultimately, you know, in San Francisco, our team had a lot of fundamental areas that we could improve on. But I think when you win, it's really easy to become complacent and to not really look and dig into things as deep as you do when you lose. And I'm not saying that we were complacent in Bermuda, but I think there was some areas that we could have really improved on. And you just have to look at Team New Zealand in San Francisco. You know, they came so close but didn't get the job done. And they went back to New Zealand after San Francisco. And, you know, it was a huge shakeup, you know, massive changes. And you just had to look at their boat to realize, you know, that they – you know, we're not going to, you know, they were going to go full noise. They were going to take as many risks as possible. They were going to push the envelope as hard as they could. And as a result, it paid off. Whereas, you know, our team, we were probably a little bit conservative in our approach, and ultimately it wasn't enough to get the job done. And I think you can see that all teams in the current America's Cup have probably learned from the experience of Oracle and also the other challenges from Bermuda, you know, that if you want to win it, you just have to go, you know, to the extreme with your design and your philosophy. And I think that's why when all the boats were launched over a year ago, you know, they all came out and everyone was like, whoa, you know, look at these things. They're just radical. And, you know, and that's what you have to do if you want to win. You can't just, you know, hope that, you know, making a small change will be enough. You need to be fully outside the box and pushing the boundaries.
Were you disappointed not to be involved this time around?
not until, you know, 2 weeks ago when the racing started. You know, after Bermuda, I was done. I was absolutely burnt out. You know, it was, you know, one of my big regrets is I think I was a bit intense in Bermuda. You know, I lived and breathed it every single minute of every day, and it was probably, you know, potentially detrimental to my performance or to the way that I operated, because it was just too much kind of thing. And so when we finished, I was just completely burnt out, and I didn't want to go and do, you know, any other foiling after Bermuda. I didn't want to go and do the World Match Racing Tour or anything that I'd done before. I just wanted to go and do something completely different. And the America's Cup was the last thing I wanted to do. And fortunately, I got the experience or the opportunity to do the Ocean Race. So that was kind of a nice way to, I guess, have a bit of a hiatus from foiling and that kind of high performance short course racing, and just go and do something completely different and, you know, try and learn a new discipline of sailing.
So tell me about that experience, because you've segued nicely onto that without me having to force the issue. I was working on that Volvo Ocean Race as well. I was delighted to see you and some of the other America's Cup sailors like Pete and Blair turning up to be part of it. But I was quite surprised, because I kind of did have you a little bit pigeonholed as this kind of match racing, high performance guy. But you don't want to be pigeonholed, right?
No, I mean, I really, you know, after spending so much time kind of doing that type of, you know, foiling, high performance sailing, I really wanted to try something different, and I was done with it, and I was really lucky, and it was actually Dirk de Ridder that, you know, pointed me in Bauer's direction, you know, saying he was looking for some guys, so got in touch with him, and I'd never been offshore before, and I mean, it's probably, yeah, probably a similar story to all my sailing. You know, first night offshore, I was useless as to be expected, and you know, it was a bit of a baptism of fire. And the only thing I think that kind of got me through was that the first night offshore, we were sailing with a very inexperienced group, so probably my incompetence was it was, you know, blended in with the rest of the inexperience in you know, in our first bit of sailing. So, you know, we were all kind of learning together, and yeah, it was a huge learning curve, but also just so much fun just to do something completely different. But there's also a lot of crossover, you know, ultimately it's still sailing. You're still trying to make a boat go fast. You're just using different tools to do that. And you know, it was just another fun challenge to try and take on something different.
And as inexperienced as you might have thought you were, you also had one of the most experienced skippers, perhaps the most experienced offshore racer in Bauer Becking. How was it sailing with Bauer? I mean, he's quite a character, but he's a super nice guy, but he doesn't suffer fools gladly either, does he?
No, I mean, the great thing about Bauer, and also I'd say the Dutch in general, is they just say it how it is, you know, so you know where you stand. Which is great, you know, especially when you're learning. And I think when you get to a point, you know, as a professional sailor, you know, you don't want people to beat around the bush. You just want to hear it straight. And I mean, maybe not as a professional sailor, but any sailor or any, you know, in any situation, high performance situation, you just need to hear facts straight so you can kind of move forward and improve. And that's why Bauer is great. And fortunately for all the young guys on board, Bauer, as well as KP, our navigator, they've been there and done that, so they've seen it all before. So for us to be able to learn off those guys was huge, you know. And it took us a little while to kind of get the hang of it, and we were pretty ordinary for the first half of the race. But you know, once we started getting it as a group, it started to click. We were, you know, we felt like we were unbeatable.
Yeah, I mean, you guys were very average until around kind of New Zealand, and then you staged a huge comeback. I heard stories of a kind of intervention by the coach at some point who sat you guys down.
Yeah,
I get that,
yep.
Right?
Yeah, that's right. That was certainly the turning point in the race. And you know, through the first part of the race, we weren't performing very well. You know, we knew we had the sailors, and we knew we had everyone's got the same equipment, so we knew we had the people to you know, make the thing go, but we just needed to make better decisions and work more cohesively. And, you know, we weren't quite, you know, pulling it off for the first half of the race, but you know, we had moments. And And in New Zealand, we got into Auckland, and I think in last place, we were basically rock bottom. You know, morale was down in the team. Everyone was kind of a little bit over it. We'd been, you know, we knew we could do better, but we just weren't doing it. And then our team coach, Anja Maraca, who's a Dutch lady who's a psychologist, she's basically sat us down. She's not a sailor, but she works with a lot of, I guess, corporate management teams and trying to get people to work better together. To make, you know, I guess, quicker and more efficient decisions. And she basically sat us down and she gave us this, you know, she basically laid everything out on the table. And, you know, she's like, Kyle, you need to do this. You know, you need to be better at this, this, this. Pete, you need to do this. Bauer, blah, blah, blah. You know, so she kind of just called everybody out in front of the group, and not in a bad or a mean way, but just to get everything out in the open. And so suddenly, you know, any issues that we had in the team were said in front of everybody. Everything was out in the open, and we could basically kind of wipe the slate clean from that point onwards. And we kind of mixed up the watch system a little bit to kind of get different people with different personalities or different behaviors to work a little bit better together so they could kind of bounce off each other. And Anja Maraca was the one who suggested that. And then, you know, we went out on the next leg and, you know, any small issues that we'd had before were suddenly gone and we were just, you know, we were off. So it was a big wake-up call, you know, for me, because I probably hadn't really valued the psychological side as much, or put as much value in it as I should have. And, you know, if I was to start a team tomorrow, she would be the first person that I would hire. You know, she is... it was unbelievable the change that she made to us and how effective it was. And it was nothing physical. It was just a couple of conversations that managed to turn our fortunes around.
Yeah, it really was. It really was such a massive change. And over the rest of that race, you guys staged a stunning comeback. I mean, you were suddenly winning legs. You were never off the podium. The boat looked fast, you know. Everybody was thinking, wow, if you guys had started like this, you'd have had the race won by now. And then it came down to that big finish at the end where there were two or three teams that could have won it. It didn't go your way, but you must have ended up feeling quite satisfied with your first Volvo Ocean Race campaign.
Yeah, well, what I've really learned about offshore racing is even if you don't win, you know, there's actually quite a sense of satisfaction of even just competing. And because it is quite an achievement to, you know, sail across an ocean. You know, I think, you know, like I was quite surprised. You know, I was like, oh, if we're not winning, you know, I'm going to be frustrated, which of course I was, you know, being a competitor. But it's also, you know, despite not winning, we finished third on equal points. You know, it was so satisfying just to have completed, you know, that challenge. And it was so different to what I was expecting and so different to what I had done in the past. And, you know, so just to be fortunate enough to compete and to sail around the world was a huge sense of accomplishment. And, you know, for sure I need to win it. It was disappointing not to tick it off straight away. So, you know, going to have to go back and try and have another crack at it. But, yeah, I mean, I think everyone on every team or anyone that has done some long offshore racing, you do feel a sense of accomplishment just getting to the finish line.
So you are going to try and have another crack at it. You signed up with 11th Hour Racing, and as we were discussing just before we started the podcast, that's kind of on pause right now because that team has switched into a double-handed sailing mode for this season. But the start of the race is, we should point out, is not until the end of next year, so it's a long way away still. But you would expect to be back with that team at the end of the year, would you?
Yeah, so I signed up with 11th Hour. The team is currently constructing a new Omaka 60 for the ocean race, but with the delay of the race and it's been delayed by 12 months, the team has decided to refocus on their efforts on the double-handed season this year, as there'll be minimal ocean race sailing. And then, you know, then the team will refocus back on the ocean race at the end of the year. So yeah, it's my intention to be involved again. But I mean, sailing double-handed or even sailing, you know, those Amoka 60s with a crew is incredibly tough, which I've done quite a bit of in the last 12 months. And then, you know, to imagine the guys sailing it double-handed and then even single-handed, I mean, it blows my mind how these, you know, those French guys in the Vendée Globe and I guess Alex as well, you know, how they can go around the world in these boats single-handed, you know, pushing the limit. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, and I mean, the team has Alex Thompson's old boat from two races ago. You did quite a lot of training with them, and I've seen all of the footage that came off the boats and the photos that Emery Ross got from the drone of you guys just screaming across the ocean with the boat in the air. Look amazing. But like you say, it strikes me that it's really tough on board, and it must be just chalk and cheese different to the VO65s.
Yeah, well, the hardest thing with the VO65 is when you're in the Southern Ocean and you're standing there driving and you've got, you know, you're surfing down 10 meter waves, you're getting washed off this steering platform, you know, you're thinking, why are we not undercover? Why are we not protected? You know, this is stupid. You know, who would design a boat like this? And then you jump on an Amoka 60 where you're undercover, you know, you're sailing in your thermals, you're not even wearing a jacket and 35 knots. And then you're thinking, oh, I wish I was outside because, you're undercover and you need to be protected because you can't physically hold on, you know, when the boat is doing 35 knots of boat speed. So you need to be undercover. But I guess the challenge with that is, you know, there's no ventilation. You know, it's kind of muggy inside. It's really uncomfortable. And I'd say probably the biggest challenge of the Amoka 60 is the upwind performance. Because downwind, they kind of perform like a traditional sailing boat. The foils don't work that great VMG running. Reaching, you know, they're a different beast. They're out of control, but you kind of have a bit more of sustained flight, I guess. But upwind is probably the most uncomfortable, I would say, because you've got, I guess, double the frequency of you've got a higher frequency of waves because, you know, when you're going into the waves and the swell, and the boats are doing 18 to 20 knots of boat speed upwind, which is unheard of for, you know, a 60-foot monohull offshore racer, I guess. And the only thing I can liken it to is going, you know, in a 25-knot breeze in your power boat, you know, going dead upwind and going full throttle and trying to stand on the bow. You know, the thing's just bouncing and, you know, the boat's airborne even upwind and just slamming down. And so that makes sleeping and just living on board, you know, near impossible. So there's certainly some livability challenges for the Amoka 60 and the way that they convert them to do the ocean race.
Yeah, it's going to be very interesting to see how that all plays out. But that's for next year. Before we get on to what you're going to be up to this coming season, if COVID allows us, I wanted to ask you about your big day out. And I've been asking guests this question now for a few episodes, and it's that day that you're going to describe to your great-grandchildren when you're too old to go sailing anymore. It's the day you'll take to your grave. You'll never, ever forget. Do you have a day like that, a day that, you know, you really just were like, wow, what a day out on the water?
Yeah, I think I have a few. But the first thing that would come to mind would be capsizing the AC-72 in San Francisco. You know, just being on that boat and just how big and powerful it was. And I think when you look back at it now, you know, we were doing 36 knots in the Barraway, which, you know, by today's standards is actually quite slow. You know, the America's Cup boats now are doing faster than that upwind. But at the time, you know, that was lightning fast. And, you know, I remember going into that Barraway, you know, never forget it, you know, realizing that the boat is capsizing and scrambling to get forward. And I was sitting on the back beam almost, and I was scrambling to get forward, knowing that if I didn't, you know, I'd have a long way to fall or kind of get catapulted off the boat. And so I kind of made it halfway down the net and then managed to grab on, you know, in the moment of impact when the wing hit, I was just holding onto the 2 millimeter netting in the middle of the trampoline, and I just kind of got flung out, and I managed to hold on. And And anyway, everybody kind of exits the yacht because the rest of the crew were in their cockpits, nice and safe. And I was, as a guest, you know, just kind of walking around the platform. And I just, I'll never forget, you know, the sound of the wing breaking apart and just hearing the carbon crashing and breaking and kind of thinking, you know, I need to get down here from this position as quickly as possible, you know, before the boat, you know, the wing breaks and folds over. And I remember Kinley Fowler was in the water and he's yelling out for me, you know, and I'm terrified of heights as well. And I was about 12 meters on a pitch poled catamaran holding onto the net. And Kinley's yelling, he's like, God, you just got to jump, you know. And I'm like, mate, I know, but I'm bloody terrified, you know. I can't. Kinley's like, just get down. I'm like, yeah, thanks, mate. You know,
wow.
And you know, looking down 12 meters, and there's the front beam with a razor edge, you know, fairing on the back of it. Thinking, oh, if I hit that, I'm going to lose my legs, and you know, I was just absolutely terrified. And anyway, I ended up jumping and getting down, but you know, and no injuries other than my fingers were bleeding from holding onto the netting. But, you know, that moment of impact I'll just never forget, and just the fear in that moment as I was, you know, fighting for survival, I guess. It was, yeah, it was intense.
Yeah, that qualifies as your big day out. That's a great one. Thank you for sharing that with us. Yeah. Now, I've got chills a little bit listening to that story. Let's take a quick look ahead now. We're into the 2021 season. You're in Sweden, but you're part of the SailGP setup again, I think.
Yeah.
I may have made an assumption there. Tell us about what sailing you're planning to do this year.
This year, I mean, with the COVID, there's not really much going ahead. Everything's kind of being cancelled. But my current plan is to, I'm joining the Team Australia for the SailGP. Again, so we're headed to Bermuda in a couple of weeks' time for the first event, and then outside of that, you know, there's not really a lot that's kind of happening now, and I've kind of got a few things here and there which may go ahead, but really I guess the big focus is the moth. So I kind of do a lot of moth sailing for fun, and I think it's a great way to stay sharp, and so I plan on, you know, if the professional sailing side does stay, you know, kind of delayed, I'll still be sailing and trying to keep my skills sharp in the moth and doing the SailGP.
And ice boating, I've got to ask you about ice boating, because I saw your name pop up in relation to ice boating and I thought, wow, what's that all about?
Yeah, I mean, that's, ice boating is probably going to be the most fun I've had on a, well, it's not even, well, I don't know if you can call it a boat, but it is unbelievable. I was lucky that the weather was quite cold in Gothenburg a few weeks ago, and a friend invited me to go out with one of his friends to try ice boating. And so I get down to this, to the harbour, which is, you know, where you'd normally go sailing from, is completely frozen over for kilometres. And this is the ocean frozen over, you know, where we should be sailing. And anyway, he goes out and does a couple of runs, and then he's like, all right, mate, you're on, kind of thing. And I jump in this ice boat, and you're lying, you know, centimetres off the ice. And the only thing he said to me was, you know, don't go, you know, between that headland and that headland over there, you know, because it's, you know, the ice is a bit thin and you'll fall through. And I didn't really understand where he meant, but I was like, oh, okay, yeah, right, kind of thing, you know. Anyway, go out off the ice and sheet on. And straight away, and I had my my Sailmon instrument with me, and straight away I was doing, you know, 35 knots, you know, without even trying. And I was just like, whoa, you know, this is insane. And it would have only been 12 knots of breeze. And so straight away, you know, the thing's just off, and there's just such low resistance, you know, as the thing's sliding across the ice. And anyway, I like look up and to try and figure out where I am, and I was like, oh shit, I'm completely lost. So I had to pull my phone out and open Google Maps to try and navigate back to the harbour, because I'd never been, you know, all the land is covered in snow and it's all white, and so I couldn't figure out how to get back there. And anyway, I eventually made my way back, and, you know, the guy gave me a few more tips, and he said, okay, you know, have another crack, and managed to hit 50 knots relatively easily. You know, and I was trying to push it, But the thing is just effortless. And I guess the only people in the world other than ice sailors that could probably really appreciate that feeling is the guys doing the America's Cup now down in down at Auckland, you know. And the I guess the only difference is these ice boats cost €3,000 versus, you know, a couple of hundred million.
That's pretty good bang for your buck, isn't it?
Yeah, it's not bad. So you know, since that experience, I've been searching the internet trying to find a decent secondhand ice boat, and you know, maybe next winter I'll try and do some racing. I mean, I was hooked.
Yeah, transferable skills from your moth sailing across to that, or just from sailing generally?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just apparent when sailing, it's very similar to the moth or to a AC or F50 or an AC75. You know, all the feeling, you know, and how to trim is all very intuitive. I was really surprised because I can't even stand on ice skates without falling over. So I'm not really a winter person. But I felt like I kind of got the hang of it reasonably quickly, and it's very intuitive. And so I would highly, highly suggest anyone to give it a go because it is so much fun.
It does. It sounds like tremendous fun.
Yeah.
You got to live in the right part of the world, and you certainly do for that. Before we wrap it up, I've got to ask you about the America's Cup. We're recording this on Monday, March the 15th. The Kiwis have just strung together 3 race wins in a row, and they're now 5-3 ahead. I guess you've been following it. I know you've been skiing, but I guess you've been keeping in touch with it.
Yeah, I've been tuning in every morning, eating my breakfast, watching the racing. I'm not quite that keen to get up at 4 a.m. to watch it, so I've just been watching it, you know, without looking at the result. But I mean, it's really surprised me. I was really expecting Team New Zealand to walk away with it, you know, based on all the information I'd heard from friends down in New Zealand. And I think, you know, Luna Rossa, I'd say they're sailing better than Team New Zealand. They're certainly starting better. But I think Team New Zealand's just got that click of performance that Prada can't match. So, I mean, it seems like passing is pretty tough. I mean, I'd be surprised if Team New Zealand don't win. But I think if Prada can make their lives hard, especially in the light air, if they can kind of box them out in the start and kind of, you know, do some good map tracing, I think they can certainly win races. But I think if the breeze is up there, then unfortunately, I think Team New Zealand might walk away with it a little bit.
From Carl Langford's point of view, which is better for you, if the cup came back to the Mediterranean or came to the Mediterranean, or if it stayed down in New Zealand, which one works best for you?
To be honest, I don't really mind. The only thing I would really love to see is more teams. And so I think wherever or, you know, whatever the format of racing or wherever it is, as long as it's attractive to get more teams involved, that's the thing I would love to see. So yeah, for me, I don't mind where it is or, you know, who wins, as long as they, you know, try and get more teams. And I think the only way to do that is by reducing costs, which is not easy when you're pushing technological boundaries to reduce costs, but, you know, they're going to have to find out a way, I think, somehow.
an opportunity for SailGP to kind of capitalize on this, because we've got so many of the cup protagonists in SailGP this season. It's a fascinating lineup that you're going to go up against, you know, when the season gets started. Is that that must be exciting prospect?
Yeah, I mean, we're pretty good mates, and we kind of talk, you know, outside of sailing as well. And you know, we've been kind of firing up lately, saying, you know, we've got to take it to these guys. You know, they're going to be coming into the SailGP season really, really well practiced and well trained, and we basically haven't sailed for over a year, so we know we're going to be rusty. But we want to take it to those guys and show them that they can't just show up and smash it up. So we know we've got our work cut out to take it to them, but we're highly motivated to take these guys on. And you know, the level this year is, you know, light years higher than it was in the first season. And so we know that if we want to win races, we need to really step it up and perform a lot better than what we have been.
Well, here's hoping that COVID-19 gives us a break and we can watch some of this racing and enjoy it enjoy watching you take them on. Kyle, thank you so much for spending the time talking to me. It's been as interesting as I knew it was going to be. I've really enjoyed it. So thanks for that. And hopefully we'll be able to check in with you kind of midway through the SailGP season and get a bit of insight from you there.
Yeah, no, thank you for having me. And yeah, hopefully the world will return to normal somewhat soon and we can all get back into it.
That's it for this episode of the Yacht Racing Podcast Extra. Thanks to Kyle Langford for sharing so openly and for all of you for subscribing and listening around the world. I'll be back very soon with the fifth and final episode for March 2021. And until then, I'll just say bye for now.